You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Happy Easter to all of you. It's so great to be together in worship this morning. Today, we join in unity with Christians throughout history and Christians around the world to come together to celebrate what we believe. And if you think about it, that's kind of a countercultural move to be here celebrating what we believe. Because increasingly in our culture, we live in a society of professed unbelief. The Pew Research Center says that there has been a rapid growth in the number of nuns over the last few decades. N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. Maybe there's been a growth in the number of N-U-N-S's also. But the nuns have grown over the past couple of decades. The nuns are those who, if you gave them a survey about religious affiliation, they would check none of the above. And now that number makes up about 28% of our society. 28%. To give you an idea, in the 1950s, it was 2%. In the 1990s, it was still less than 10%. So it's grown significantly over just a few decades. Some of those 28% would identify as atheist or agnostic. Some would just say, I have no religious belief in particular. But suffice it to say, more than a quarter of our culture would say, I have no belief at all or no belief in particular. More than a quarter. That's a lot. That's a lot. But I think if the poll were measuring actual unbelief in God rather than just measuring religious affiliation, I think the number would be a lot higher than 28%. I think it'd be more like 100%, right? Because unbelief is a reality for everyone. Even for those of us who call ourselves believers, unbelief is a reality. We're all just a mixed bag of belief and unbelief when it comes to God. It usually just depends on how we're doing in that particular moment, right? Because unbelief is not simply belief in nothing. Unbelief is just belief in something else or someone else. And everyone believes in something or someone at all times, even the nuns. So the question is your belief well placed? Can your belief support your life? Our church has spent the last few months in the Gospel of John. And one thing you notice about John's gospel is his emphasis on belief. That word believe gets used over 100 times in the Gospel of John. And John is calling us to believe something very specific. And here in John chapter 20, his call to belief reaches its pinnacle, its highest point. The resurrection of Jesus is the one belief that we have as Christians that everything else hinges on. Because if Jesus is not raised from the dead, then Christianity is at best inspirational, motivational. But at worst, it's an evil lie. Because if Jesus is not raised from the dead, that means that billions of people throughout history have given their lives to a man who did not deliver on his promises. So belief in the resurrected Jesus is the belief of beliefs. If it's true, it changes everything. If it's false, then we might as well just believe in the Easter Bunny, right? We'd be better off. But as John tells the story of that first Easter, you just heard it, the resurrected Jesus was not met with belief, but with various forms of unbelief. And not from his enemies, but from his friends, from those who loved him the most. And so apparently belief in the risen Jesus is not something you just decide to have. It's not something you just kind of muster up. This text, I think, shows us that belief itself is a gift. It's a grace given to us by Jesus. And so maybe you are wrestling with unbelief in your life. That's okay. That's okay, because I want you to see in John 20 how the risen Jesus graciously meets three different types of people in their various forms of unbelief, and then he moves toward them personally, and he gives them the gift of belief. These people, I think, represent all of us in some way. So first, let's look at the gift of belief for the churched, for the church folk, which is a lot of us. Look at John 20, verse 1. It's on page 852 in the Bibles in front of you, if you want to turn there. Page 852. John 20, verse 1. The gift of belief for the churched. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it's still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. That's John, the one who's writing this. And she said to Peter and John, "Hey, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've laid him." Now, we're gonna come back to Mary Magdalene in a little bit, but it's worth asking. Why is she the first? Why is she the only one, it seems? And why is she the first one at the tomb? Like, where is everybody else? Where are Peter and John and James and Matthew and Philip? Like, where are the inner circle guys? Where are the church folks on Easter Sunday morning? Those guys were the ones who had been up close with Jesus. They'd been in his small group for 3 years. And you know what he kept telling them over and over and over in small group? I'll give you a few of Matthew's journal entries from small group with Jesus. This is right out of Matthew's moleskin. Matthew 16 says, "Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things and be killed, and on the third day be raised." Matthew 17, "Jesus said to his disciples, 'The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day.'" Matthew 20, "Jesus said to his disciples, 'Hey, we're going up to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and I will be raised on the third day.'" So third day, third day, third day. Friday, that's day one. Saturday, that's day two. Sunday, day three. Don't you think they'd be a little curious? Don't you think they'd be like, "Well, you know, he kept saying third day. Maybe you should go down there to the tomb and check things out." But they didn't. They stayed back at the house. And they didn't go, I think, because they had seen Jesus die. They saw it, right? Jesus had been thoroughly defeated. And in their minds, the oppressors had won. Rome had won. The religious leaders had won. Death had won. Jesus had been thoroughly defeated, and they had witnessed it. And they're like, "Jesus, it was a good run, but I guess it didn't work out. Nice try." They didn't believe. Their absence at the tomb is actually a form of unbelief from the church folks. But watch what happens in verse 3. After Mary Magdalene came to get them, it says in verse 3, "So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running." Peter and John were running together. "But the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first." I love that little detail. It's always a race with guys. Doesn't matter where you're going, you're racing. John's like, "I just wanted you to know who got there first. It was me." Verse 5, "And stooping to look in, he," John, "saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him, and in classic Peter fashion, went into the tomb. He ran right in, and he saw the linen cloths lying there, and he saw the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself." So you had the linen cloths lying there, and then you had the face cloth just folded up where Jesus' head had been. Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, that is John, also went in and he saw and he believed. He saw and he believed. John didn't see Jesus' grave clothes and think, oh no, somebody stole the body. Because that would be silly. You would not unwrap a corpse before you stole the body. That would be nasty, right? And if you were stealing a body, you wouldn't take the time to fold up the face cloth and lay it on the side nicely because you'd be in a hurry. When John sees the grave clothes, he believes. He believes in the risen Christ. I think this moment is Jesus' grace toward his disciples because he left them a big old hint that he had been resurrected. He left his grave clothes, which whispered, Jesus was here, but he's not anymore. He's not. Believe. Believe in the risen Christ. It's grace toward the unbelieving church folk. Later that evening, Sunday evening, Jesus showed them even more grace. He appeared to them. Look down at verse 19. Verse 19, on the evening of that day, that same day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, they're hiding. Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, peace be with you. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. They saw the Lord. They saw the risen Lord and they believed in the risen Lord. But make no mistake, their belief was a gift given to them by Jesus himself. They did not believe because they were smarter than everyone else, because they were better than everyone else. They did not believe because they had carefully exegeted the scriptures. In fact, verse 9 says they did not understand the scriptures. They're like, I don't know, we don't get it. They didn't get it. No, they believed because Jesus revealed himself to them. Belief was a gift. I mean, during their 3 years with Jesus, they had been so up close with Jesus that they had missed the most important promise that he gave them ever, and he kept saying it over and over and over, and they missed it. It was unbelief due to over-familiarity. They were churched, but they were struggling with unbelief. Maybe this is you sometimes. It's definitely me sometimes. Like maybe you struggle with unbelief because everything is so familiar to you. You've been in church since you were a baby. You can say the books of the Bible backward and forward without even thinking about it, right? You've been up close with Jesus, you've experienced the gospel, but it's all so familiar to you that it's just kind of like white noise to you. Like you've lost your wonder in the fact that Jesus is alive. And so you're living as if the oppressors have won. Sin and death have won. In our unbelief, the risen Christ comes to us and says, believe. Recover the wonder in my resurrection. Belief is a gift for us, for the church. It's a grace. We need his grace to keep on believing. Now, there's a second type of person that Jesus moves toward here. Let's look at his gift, the gift of belief for the marginalized and for the broken, the marginalized and broken. We see this in Mary Magdalene. Look at verse 11. Verse 11. Peter and John had gone back to their homes after they went down to the tomb. But in verse 11, it says, Mary Magdalene stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look in to the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. They said to her, woman, why are you weeping? She said to them, they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him. Having said this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to her, woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking? Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away. Mary's belief in Jesus is sincere. She's so earnest, but her belief is incomplete, isn't it? Like, she's looking for Jesus. She's just looking for the wrong Jesus. She's looking for the dead Jesus. And that Jesus does not apparently exist anymore, right? So she is so focused, like, on her grief that she misses the glory all around her. Like, she has two angels in front of her, and literally she has the risen Christ standing behind her, and her assessment of this moment is, this is terrible. This is awful. Like, somebody stole Jesus. Hey, do you guys know where he is? She just wants to be near Jesus because he's the one who treated her with such dignity, with such love. He's the one that brought healing to her troubled life. And so she just wants to be close to him, even if it's just up close to his dead body, which is why she got to the tomb so early that morning. Now, watch the grace of Jesus at work in Mary's situation. Look at verse 15. Jesus moves toward her. He initiates. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she turned and said to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Mary can't find Jesus even though he's standing right in front of her. Even though her quest for him is so sincere, she's so earnest in her pursuit of Jesus, she can't find him. And he's right there. So he has to find her. And he does. He does. He initiates with her. He starts the conversation. And when she does not recognize him, I love the intimate simplicity of what he does. He just says her name, Mary. It's the shortest sermon in the Bible. It's a sermon, he's speaking right to Mary. Mary. And her eyes are open, and in that moment, she moves from unbelief to belief. Remember what Jesus said in John chapter 10? He said, "The shepherd calls his sheep by name, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice." That's how salvation works. Jesus finds you, he calls your name, and then you believe and follow him. That's the order. First, Jesus says, "Mary," and then and only then does she believe. Belief in the resurrected Jesus is a gift. And we know Mary believes because of what happens next. She gives Jesus a big old hug. Look at verse 17. Apparently, Jesus is not a ghost. He's not a spirit. He's not a hallucination because she's hugging him. Verse 17, Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me." What it really means is, "Do not keep clinging to me. For I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God." When Jesus says, "Don't cling to me," he's not saying, "Don't touch me, Mary." He's saying, "All right, Mary, you're gonna have to let go of me at some point. I'm not going anywhere right now," right? "You don't have to cling to me so tightly like I'm gonna disappear or something." She had him in a long, intense hug, and she was not letting go. I've told this story before, but 31 years ago, on Easter weekend, I met my wife's family for the first time. We were dating, and I went to spend Easter weekend with her family. And my wife, Amy, told me, she warned me, she said, "Hey, when my grandma gets here on Easter Sunday, she's gonna give you a hug, even though you've never met her before, and she's never met you before." She warned me. On Easter Sunday, Grandma and Grandpa Thompson, we called them Grandma and Grandpa T, they pulled up, and I saw her coming across the yard, and she was coming right for me, and she was kind of like this, you know, purse hanging down from the arm. She was coming for me, and she embraced me with like the tightest bear hug that I think I've ever had before, and she was not letting go. And let's just say, when Grandma T hugs you, you felt very near to her, right? There were no gaps, right? There's no air pockets in here, right? She hugged me like that every time I saw her until she passed away in 2009. You know, she passed away on Easter Sunday in 2009. First hug on Easter. Whenever I read this story about Mary Magdalene, I always picture Mary giving Jesus like a grandma tea hug. Like she just has got him, just tight embrace, and she doesn't want to let him go because she's found him. Or better said, he's found her. And she just wants to cling to him. But Jesus says, hey, you can't keep clinging to me because I'm going to the Father so that I can send the Spirit, so that more and more people can experience my love and my nearness. I've got grandma tea hugs for lots of people, starting with my disciples. He calls them brothers. He doesn't say starting with those unbelieving knuckleheads. No, he says starting with my brothers. Go tell my brothers. And he sends Mary to tell the apostles. Think about the significance of that. Like, why did Jesus wait until it was only Mary Magdalene at the tomb to reveal himself? Why did he not reveal himself to Peter and John when they were there earlier? They were in his inner circle. I mean, this is the most glorious moment of Jesus' time on earth. He has just conquered death. You'd think he'd want as much publicity as possible. You'd think he'd go tell all the higher-ups in society. He'd go tell all the influencers. Get the word out, draw a crowd, spread the word, but that's not what he does. The first thing he does is to have a private meeting with one woman. And surprisingly, it was a woman who had a long history of severe mental illness. She had dealt with severe mental illness. We're told that Jesus had cast seven demons out of Mary Magdalene. She was not some well-respected pillar of the community. She was messed up. And she was on the margins. And yet Jesus, in his grace, chose Mary to be the first person to see the resurrected Christ. And then he sent her to tell his disciples. I love that. St. Augustine called Mary Magdalene the apostle to the apostles. Meaning she was the one who witnessed to the ones who would witness to the world. Mary was on the margins. She was not a prominent member of society, and yet Jesus came to her first. You see what he's saying in this? He's saying salvation is by grace. It's a wide open invitation. Anyone can come to me, no matter your class, your standing, your record of righteousness, your resume, no matter how much you've sinned or how much you've struggled or how many crazy things you've done, you can come to me. Maybe you feel like Mary at times. Maybe you feel like you're the kind of person who might be on the outs with Jesus, right? You don't see yourself as a spiritual leader or a spiritual insider or a pillar of the church in any way. And you think if Jesus just knew what I've thought or said or done, even this week, he would not accept me. He would not love me. And to you, Jesus says, I do love you. I know your name. And I have a grandma tea hug for you. Believe in me and experience my intimate presence. Belief in the risen Jesus is a gift for the marginalized, for the broken. Let's end by looking at one more person. Let's look at the gift of belief for the skeptic. For the skeptic. Later that evening, after Jesus was with Mary Magdalene, he appeared to his disciples. We already read about that in verses 19 and 20. But look at what happens in verse 24. Verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with the other disciples when Jesus came. That was a bummer for Thomas, right? Jesus showed up and Thomas was not there. The lesson for us is don't miss church, right? Because something really big might happen. Anything good happen at church today? Well, the risen Christ showed up in the flesh, so that was cool. Should have been there, Thomas. Verse 25. So the other disciples told him, Thomas, we've seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. Thomas gives his criteria for belief here. He's like, I will not believe unless I see his wounds and unless I touch his wounds. Even though my 10 best friends in the whole world are telling me, no, Thomas, we saw him. It was real. It was really Jesus. I won't believe until my criteria are met. Thomas is the consummate modern man, isn't he? Like he only trusts in his senses, in his reason, in empirical evidence. I need empirical evidence that this is true. And I think a lot of times Thomas gets a bad rap for his skepticism here, but I think he's doing all of us an incredible favor in this moment, because I think he's raising the question that we should all be asking about the resurrection of Jesus, which is this real? Like, did Jesus really raise from the dead? Like, physically, actually? Or is the resurrection of Jesus just kind of a nice sentimental story to make us feel better about death? Is it just kind of a metaphor about life and springtime and bunnies and stuff and make us feel better? Or is he really physically alive? I think we ought to thank Thomas for raising the question, because it's the right question. Because if Jesus is not really raised from the dead, then we should have just slept in this morning. We should figure out something else to do with our Sundays next week and the week after, right? See, we need the resurrection of Jesus to be real to make any real difference in the world, in our own lives. And through Thomas, we get to see someone having a real hands-on experience with the resurrected Jesus. Look what happens. Verse 26, 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them this time. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side." Jesus does not waste any time, does he? He's like, "Peace be to all of y'all. Now, Thomas, let's talk about those questions you had." He goes right to Thomas. He doesn't blast Thomas for his doubts. He doesn't avoid Thomas in some kind of awkward, passive-aggressive way. He moves toward Thomas, and he meets him in the exact place of his doubts. Like, he accommodates Thomas's criteria to a T. He's like, "Hey, put your hand, touch that, right? Feel that, right? No, put your hand over here." He accommodates Thomas. What grace that he would do that, right? The risen Jesus honors the honest doubts of Thomas. And maybe this is you sometimes. Maybe you're like Thomas. Maybe you're struggling with doubts when it comes to Jesus. And the good news is Jesus is not afraid of your doubts. He's not offended by your doubts. But let me ask you this. Would you be willing to deal honestly with your doubts? To actually search for answers in your doubts? Like, would you be willing to doubt your doubts? Because on the flip side of any doubt is just a belief in something else, right? So if you're skeptical about the risen Jesus, that can be a good thing. I think it is a good thing, because anything worth believing in is worth questioning. But don't let your skepticism be a dead end, right? Like, don't leave it there. Ask Jesus to meet you in your doubts. That's what he does with Thomas. Jesus doesn't leave Thomas in his doubt. He actually says to Thomas, "Don't disbelieve, but believe." Don't disbelieve, believe. And then watch what happens in verse 28. I love this. Verse 28, Thomas answered Jesus, "My Lord and my God." Did you know that this is the only time in all four Gospels when Jesus is directly addressed by someone else as God? That's hard to believe, isn't it? Because the Gospels are very clear about the deity of Jesus, but usually people just refer to him as the Son of God, or when they're talking to him directly, they refer to him as Lord. But here, Jesus is given the loftiest title possible by a skeptic, no less. Here, he's addressed as the God, which tells us something. When a skeptic believes, they understand the implications of their beliefs, because they've questioned their beliefs. Thomas confesses that Jesus is not merely a good man. He's not merely a good teacher. He is God with us. Thomas believes in the risen Jesus. But listen, only because Jesus came to him by grace. Belief in Jesus is a gift from Jesus. And I love how Jesus ends here in verse 29. He ends by giving a blessing, a benediction to the rest of us who would one day believe in Jesus. Look at verse 29. Jesus said to Thomas, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. See, the disciples and Mary Magdalene and Thomas, they became believers when they saw the risen Jesus. But the rest of us are called to believe in Jesus based on their testimony that they've given, right? So Jesus, in his grace, blesses us in that to help enable us to do that. How gracious of him. How gracious. Belief in Jesus is a gift. Everyone believes in something or someone, even the nuns. And the question is your belief well-placed? Like, can it support your life? Can it give you life? Jesus is uniquely qualified to give us life. In fact, in verse 31, John says that the whole reason he wrote his gospel is so that we would believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that by believing that we would receive life in his name. Jesus came to give us life and all that life entails, past, present, and future. Because Jesus is risen, our past is forgiven. Because Jesus is risen, our present relationship with God is intimate. Because Jesus is risen, our future is certain. Our future is secure because death does not win. And it's so gracious of Jesus to bless us that we might believe in him. The very thing he calls us to, which is to believe in him, he gives us. Isn't that great? He calls us to believe in him. He gives us the gift of belief. It's grace. Let's thank him for that.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.